It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Food insecurity and hunger are at an all-time high due to the COVID-19 pandemic. This means the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank is working harder than ever to provide food assistance. At the same time, the food bank is celebrating 40 years of serving the community this month. That's hundreds of millions of meals served to people in Allegheny and surrounding counties since 1980. Lisa Scales is president and CEO of the food bank. Lisa, welcome and happy anniversary.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin. Happy to be here with you.
Lisa, it's the holidays. Food banks often do holiday meal distribution. This isn't a normal year, as we all know. So what are operations like at the food bank right now?
Well, we've been extremely busy, especially in the past several weeks. The holidays are always a busy time for us. But because of the pandemic, we've seen a significant increase in need just in the last 2 weeks.
What has had to change for you in getting the food to the individuals due to the pandemic and restrictions?
We had to cancel our produce to people distributions, where people would line up as many as 100 or 200 people. So we established our drive-up distributions that were a low-touch distribution where we were putting emergency food boxes in the trunk of people's cars. Our pantries also had to distribute food differently. People could not come inside and walk through the pantry and select the items. Instead, our pantry set appointments or they received emergency food boxes from us.
Mm-hmm. So food security is hitting a peak, as we mentioned. Many people struggling financially. What was the moment when you realized we're operating in a long-term crisis, you know, during this pandemic, aside from the food bank operating for 40 years now?
Yes, that realization really sunk in early on in the spring. We started to plan for the next 1 or 2 years, knowing that the need would remain high even after even after we have a vaccine and the pandemic is no longer spreading.
And you're planning well into 2021?
Yes, we are. Yes, we have contingency plans in place here at the food bank, but then longer term, we're continuing with some of the programs that we started this spring, such as doorstep delivery, which is a home delivery program. We also added a number of new organizations to our vast network of over 500 partners, and our goal has been to get food closer to where people are and when they need it. And we'll be I'm very excited about in early 2021, we will be testing out some new programs so that, again, we can get food closer to people.
Such as, can you give us a little hint?
Well, we did just now roll out a program that we're piloting with Feeding America, our national network leader, and it's called Order Ahead. And people are able to go online and place an order for food. So this is getting out food directly to individuals. The first time we did a social media blast about that program, it generated an 800% increase in people requesting emergency food orders through that program.
One change that's happened over the years, now you've been president and CEO, I believe, for 8 years, but with the food bank for more than 20. One change we've seen is more of an emphasis on availability is to, along with the shelf stable food, but promoting distribution of fresh produce. Has that caused any logistical problems, the need for maybe more cold storage?
When I started here in 1996, fresh produce was a very small percentage of the food that we distributed, less than maybe 1% of the food we distributed. This past year, we distributed 12 million pounds of fresh produce. That was 35% of our distribution. And our goal over the next 5 years is that we will continue to build that, and fresh produce will be 50% of our distribution, or 20 million pounds a year.
Yeah.
But in order to do that, we're undergoing a major renovation of our facility to be able to safely store and pack and then deliver the fresh food.
40 years for the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. Do you expect that your organization will be needed 10, 20, even 40 years from now?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we were established in 1980 to respond to the dramatic need in the region when the steel industry collapsed. 40 years later, hunger and food insecurity is once again at an all-time high due to the pandemic. And so when I look then ahead, our services will be needed. I would love to be able to say we will be able to close our doors and no longer be in existence. And I would hope that that could be the case someday. But we know that there are people who will always be in need of services.
Lisa Scales is president and CEO of the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for your services to the residents of our region.
Well, you're welcome. It's an honor to do this work and to carry out our mission every day. Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. After December 29th, we will no longer hear that warm, friendly, curious, inquisitive voice of David Greene hosting Morning Edition. After 15 years at NPR, including the last eight with Morning Edition, David is leaving the network for a new adventure, and he joins us now. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
You're leaving at the pinnacle of your time at NPR, hosting a show heard by millions, and you're still very young. So why?
Wow, I like the very young. You've made my year. This was the hardest decision of my career. I love the network. I love NPR. I love Morning Edition. I love my co-hosts. I love our executive producer, Kenya Young. I mean, it just, you know, after 8 years, the hours certainly wear you down. And, you know, who knows, maybe I'll be back someday. But it just feels like trying something new, you know, the time is right for that.
David, my favorite part of the job is I get to talk to people and learn about them. There's a lot of variety as a host. I remember when you were Moscow correspondent, though, and you traveled the Trans-Siberian Railroad, you seemed to really enjoy getting to know people along that journey.
You just articulated it so beautifully. I mean, I just love people. I love this idea that everyone has a story to tell, and, you know, it's just a matter of finding it. So I've been so lucky to get to talk to celebrities and movie stars and heads of state. And I mean, it's been great. And I feel so lucky to have been sitting in that chair. But what really has inspired and moved me is just meeting people like along a journey, like you say, on the Trans-Siberian, and learning what I don't know about a country and a culture like Russia, just from what people are going through and struggling with in their everyday life. And so, yeah, it was Russia. It was when I've traveled around the United States doing stories. I mean, people are just inspiring.
The thing that I've always been impressed with is you sound as comfortable talking with a musician, a healthcare worker being overwhelmed by the pandemic. We hear that empathy in your voice. And then the reporter comes out, you know, really pressing for an answer, say with New York City Mayor de Blasio, why didn't you impose restrictions sooner? So you have a knack for being able to do all of those.
That's both the most fulfilling part of this job, I think, and also the hardest. I mean, you have to be versatile. And yeah, like some of those, you know, tough interviews where you really have to hold people in power accountable, especially in today's political climate. I mean, it is so challenging, and you've got to just feel the weight of that responsibility, but also treat someone like a human being. And, you know, there's some days when you don't get that right. There's some days when you don't ask the questions as tough as you wanted to. And some days where you feel like you let someone off too easy or you were too aggressive. And that's just always going to be the case. Every interview is different. But as long as you come at it with feeling that sense of responsibility, holding people in power accountable for the sake of our listeners and for voters who put them in that position of power, and treating them like a human being and being curious, I'd like to think that if you can come into even the hardest interview with an approach like that, you know, something is going to go well.
You've done thousands of interviews. You recently tweeted, I have teared up twice while reading intros. The first time, June 26, 2015, while saying, quote, gay marriage is now legal across the United States of America. And earlier this month, saying a 90-year-old British woman was the first person to receive a new vaccine for COVID-19. There are stories that do get to you.
100%. And, you know, you can't take away your humanity. And you know, I don't think anyone would expect that. I think I can be a listener. I can be fair. I'm not going to bring, you know, my own political biases into this job. But I also, you know, I'm a human being. I think that's part of the beauty of the work we do. You know, in public radio, I think our listeners want to feel an intimate and human connection with us. And so not only would I feel like I was being fake by not being a human being, I also think that I would, you know, I'd be turning my back on our listeners, because I really come to this job feeling like we, you know, you and I and all of our listeners are kind of in this together. And we're all humans and we all, you know, have emotions and reactions. And, I'm not going to hide that.
In announcing that you were leaving NPR, you somewhat cryptically posted emojis on social media, a football, a Steelers logo, wine, and a radio. Come on, what's all that mean?
Honestly, I'm not trying to be cryptic, and I swear it is not like I have something lined up that I'm hiding. I really am taking a little time to think. So the wine, I'm talking to my wife about maybe going into some sort of business with her and maybe some other friends, in the culinary industry, combining storytelling, combining some of the work that my wife has done to lift up, you know, people who are, you know, less appreciated, maybe some, you know, people some from far-flung countries who make wine, who make food, and sort of elevate people who deserve to be recognized for the work they're doing in the culinary industry. And I'm thinking about another book, maybe part memoir, but that's where the sports come in. Like, I would love to dig into my own obsession with the Steelers, with sports, with Pittsburgh sports, and see if there's something there. And then the radio, you know, I'm sort of seeing what's out there in terms of the possibility for some sort of podcast or show. You can tell it's all kind of up there bubbling in my mind, and I haven't settled on anything yet, but so far it's been kind of fun to just open up the possibilities and think about what might be out there.
David Greene leaves as Morning Edition host, and he leaves NPR at the end of the month. David, you're going to be missed, buddy. Thanks so much for your wonderful work and for these occasional chats with me.
Well, listen, I've loved our chats, and thanks to you, thanks to your whole team. You do amazing work for Pittsburgh, and thanks to all of your listeners for all of your support, both to WESA and to NPR in general. And I'm going to miss all of you, but I'm going to be right there listening with you to Kevin, and we'll move on together.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. NASA plans to send a manned mission to the moon for the first time since 1972. The Artemis program has an ambitious timeline, 2024. The goal was twofold: return a man and put the first woman on the moon. Second, establish sustainable lunar exploration. One of the 18 astronauts selected for this program is Warren Woody Hoberg. He's a Pittsburgh native. He spoke with The Confluence's Mary Lee Williams.
So, Woody, what's your role in this project specifically?
My role is to train to be ready to fly in space, but I should be clear, this is not a flight assignment at this time. So just generally staying trained and ready to fly in space is certainly one of our jobs as astronauts here. More specifically, many of our astronauts are used for things like hardware evaluations, developing the procedures that are going to be needed for Artemis, working with some of the companies that are building the human landing system. It's a quite varied schedule, but we get pretty involved in getting these missions off the ground.
So you said in a NASA video, you talked about the first rocket that you built that's stored in your parents' barn currently. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that rocket is that you built?
Yeah, that was just a hobby I had growing up. I built large amateur rockets. I got really into it through something called the Tripoli Rocketry Association. I graduated from small hobby store rockets into building lots of the components from scratch in my parents' garage. What inspired me to do that was just all of the launches where I would meet up with other people that were enthusiastic about this and fly these rockets. So it was something that I got very excited about in sort of high school and college.
So was that kind of when you started making the decision that you thought space, aeronautics was something you wanted to do?
Yeah, very much. I always liked things that fly, and I think I really cemented that through the rocketry hobby. I didn't have enough money then to take flying lessons, though I did do that later. But yeah, I think in hindsight, participating in amateur rocketry is what ultimately got me excited about aerospace engineering.
The Artemis Project, this isn't just a trip in and a trip out. The Artemis Project looks to take astronauts long-term into deep space. Just how difficult is it to set up an outpost in deep space?
Well, it's much more challenging than low Earth orbit. But when we look at going out beyond low Earth orbit, several things happen. We have to deal with radiation. We have to deal with longer duration missions where we need more food and consumables and more fuel. And some of the engineering of the vehicles gets more difficult. And at a high level, we're going down into another gravity well. So when we're on the surface of the moon, we can't just simply do a small deorbit burn and return home like we can from low Earth orbit. We have to actually fly up off the surface and use a lot of fuel in order to get home. And so that really changes the high-level concept of operations of the entire mission. And so I think one of the things that's special about the moon is it allows us to practice some of the technologies and techniques that we are going to need to get to Mars.
People have talked about this, but does that mean that the moon can kind of be a stepping stone where people can get fuel, get supplies, and then get to Mars?
I think the moon is very much a stepping stone to Mars in the sense that it's a proving ground. To be clear, I am not saying that I think we would stop at the moon on the way to an actual mission to Mars.
And so my final question is, will you be following the tradition of other astronauts from the Pittsburgh area who have taken a terrible towel into space?
Definitely.
All right. Well, that's really good to know. Warren Woody Hoberg is a Pittsburgh native and one of the 18 astronauts selected for the Artemis Project. Thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.